Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Alien Torts and Corporate Liability Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On February 28, 2012, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Coyabel v. Royal Dutch Petroleum and Mohammed v. Rajab. Coyabel involves the Alien Tort Statute, or ATS, which permits non-U.S. citizens to bring a lawsuit in federal court in order to seek relief for certain violations of international law. Question is whether corporations, and not merely individuals, can be held liable on an ATS lawsuit, and whether that issue affects the jurisdiction of the court even to hear the case. Mohammed involves the Torture Victim Protection Act, or TVPA, and presents a similar question, whether corporations, and not merely natural persons, can be held liable for violations of TVPA. To discuss the cases, we have Eugene Kontorovich, who is a professor at the Northwestern University School of Law. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Kontorovich will first discuss the Supreme Court's decision to put the case back on the calendar for re-argument next year.
On Tuesday, March 5th, 2012, the week after oral arguments in Coyabel v. Royal Dutch Shell, there was a very dramatic development in the case, which puts the case in an altogether new light and also extends the time over which it will be decided. And I'll say a few words about that new development, and then we'll get into the discussion of the issues raised in Coyabel so far and how the oral argument went last week. So Coyabel is a case about corporate liability under the Alien Tort Statute. But there were some other things happening in the case which became clear at oral argument had caught the judge's attention as being maybe even more important or more troublesome. Now, the Alien Tort Statute is a 200-year-old statute which allows aliens to sue for torts in violation of the law of nations in United States courts, and it hadn't been used for a couple hundred years until it was brought to life by the Second Circuit in 1980 in a case called Philardega. And the litigation that has ensued has become used as a vehicle for litigating international human rights violations in U.S. courts. Now, Coyabel is typical of these cases in that it's what has come to be called a foreign-cubed lawsuit. And a foreign cube lawsuit means the plaintiff is an alien, and we know that's okay because the statute specifically talks about the plaintiff being an alien. But the defendant is also an alien. So it's a foreigner suing a foreigner, and the cubed part is for things that did not take place in the United States and don't have any nexus in the United States. So this is a lawsuit about something that happened abroad in Nigeria between a foreign company and local residents. And the first ATS lawsuit in modern times, Philardega, was also a foreign cubed lawsuit. It was a Paraguayan suing another Paraguayan for alleged torture in Paraguay itself. So it had not yet really been addressed by the Supreme Court why this kind of foreign cubed business is okay. It is certainly it would be highly anomalous under any other statute. There was some general sense that international law provides the rule of decision, so maybe the scope is international. And courts had gone along with that assumption, much as they had gone along with the assumption that corporations can be properly held liable, and until recently it had not been squarely challenged. Now, in another case, apart from Coyabel, the Ninth Circuit, in a case called Rio Tinto, just a few months ago, issued a highly divided en banc opinion, which upheld the extraterritorial application of the Alien Tort Statute. So it said it could apply to foreign-cubed things. It provided the third part of the cube. It could apply foreigner against foreigners for things totally outside of the United States. But there were a number of strong dissents in that en banc case on the issue of extraterritoriality. And the court had asked to hear, to review the Ninth Circuit's en banc case. And what they have basically done is combine that issue into the Coyabel case by asking the Coyabel parties to brief the issue of extraterritoriality, which is also presented in Coyabel. So they're taking on this issue as well, effectively incorporating the Rio Tinto case or the extraterritoriality issue from there into this. So let's talk about the merits of this extraterritoriality issue. It seems there's a few possibilities. First of all, these suits could only encompass foreign-cubed conduct in the most generous understanding, for if the offenses alleged are what's called universal jurisdiction offenses in international law. So there's a subset of international law norms for which suit can be brought in any country because they are so egregious. And torture is an example of those. Now, that's the absolute maximum potential extraterritoriality, because if it's not universal jurisdiction in the law of nations, then it is not clear how the United States has authority to deal with that issue. Now, that's the outer limit, because this is under the Congress's offenses clause power. So if the offense is not universal in international law, then surely a statute refers to international law cannot create this universal jurisdiction. Now, many of the ATF's causes of action have not been universally recognizable, and in general, courts have not conducted any particular inquiry as to whether they really robustly meet international standards for universal jurisdiction, and have taken a pretty relaxed approach to that. That seems unlikely to be allowed to continue. Now, even if international law allows it to be universal jurisdiction, then there's a second question. Did Congress actually authorize courts to go to the far extreme of international law and use maximal universal jurisdictional powers as permitted by international law? Normally, in federal statutes, there's a presumption against extraterritoriality. Statutes are not supposed to regulate conduct outside of the U.S., especially if there's no connection with the U.S., and that presumption has been applied with increasing strength in recent years. So one might think that that presumption would apply to the ATS as well, and like many jurisdictional statutes, it does not give the courts the full scope of the constitutional powers that Congress could, even if it uses language similar to the relevant constitutional provisions. That's the case for the diversity jurisdiction statute and numerous others. So Congress could choose to give the court less than the Constitution allows. Now, the Ninth Circuit said, no, this has to be extraterritorial, because we know that one of the offenses that the ATS had in mind when it was passed by the founding generation was piracy, and piracy, by definition, takes place overseas. Now, there's a lot one could say about that, and the majority's treatment of piracy was extremely casual and historically inaccurate. First of all, piracy involves attacks on ships which all fly the flag of one nation or another, so it does involve the territory of the United States if U.S. ships are attacked. But they also seem to entirely ignore an important case from 1820, a Supreme Court case, United States versus Furlong, in which Justice Marshall, the Marshall Court, held that the criminal piracy statute passed by Congress, even though it uses the words any person who commits piracy, doesn't actually mean any person. It only means piracy involving American ships, does not imply to piracy purely between foreigners, even though international law clearly would have authorized that. The Marshall Court thought even a statute dealing squarely with piracy should be read to limit extraterritorial application. And I think that case Furlong is going to be vastly important to the court decision here. And now we'll turn to the issues of corporate liability discussed in COIBO itself so far, which are independent of the extraterritoriality issue. The court could decide that there is no extraterritorial application. It would still matter whether there's corporate liability for the purpose of suing American-based companies, or they could decide that it is extraterritorial, in which case the corporate liability issue would be very important. And they're separate issues, both analytically and practically.
And now, Professor Kontrovich will discuss the issues related to these cases and what transpired during the oral argument.
These cases bring together corporate greed, human rights abuses, an ancient and obscure statute passed by the founding generation, and the Pirates of the Caribbean, the actual historical Pirates of the Caribbean. So it's much more exciting than the typical tort suit, which is probably why the Supreme Court is hearing it. So in Coibo versus Royal Dutch Shell, the issue is whether corporations, as opposed to the individuals who act and work for them, can be held liable as an entity for violating international law under the Alien Tort Statute. In the Mohammed case, it's brought under another statute, the Torture Victim Protection Act, where Congress actually specifies liability regime for a particular international law crime, torture, and says that individuals can be held liable. So the question there is, in that statute, is a corporation an individual? So we'll talk mostly about COIBO, the background, the issues that arise, the things the justices seemed interested in oral argument, and then talk briefly about Muhammad. So the Alien Tort Statute, as it's known, is actually part of the First Judiciary Act, the statute passed by the First Congress in 1790, organizing the federal court system. And it had a provision, which has come to be called the ATS, which said that district courts shall have jurisdiction in tort only for suits brought by aliens for violations of the law of nations. Suits brought by aliens in tort for violations of the law of nations. Now, aliens are people who are not American citizens, and law of nations is what we today would call international law. Now, that statute sat on the books and did nothing but gather dust
a bit of an appendix type thing, a throwback, a thing which no one really knew its function. It just sat there, like the tonsils in the federal code, until about 1980, almost 200 years later, when it was dusted off by human rights groups as a vehicle to bring lawsuits for human rights abuses around the world in U.S. courts, because human rights abuses can be violations of the law of nations. They are torts. And the plaintiffs are aliens. And in 1980, the Second Circuit approved this use of the statute in a suit called Filardiga, in which Paraguayan sued another Paraguayan for torture committed in Paraguay, which was a violation of international law, the court found, and that was brought in the U.S. federal court. And that really opened up several waves of human rights litigation under this statute, and there are roughly three waves that could be discerned. First, people who were sued were, like the defendant in Filardiga, individual malefactors, so low-level, mid-level torturers and whatnot. But those lawsuits were not so attractive because these guys don't generally have so much money. And then the second wave was against various government officials, ministers, heads of state. But those lawsuits were blocked by governmental immunities and sovereign immunities. And now the third wave are lawsuits against large multinational corporations for alleging that they abetted or somehow facilitated or knew about and were in some way indirectly promoted human rights violations by the countries in which they operated. Usually these are corporations like the defendant in this case, Shell, involved in the extractive industries in third world countries with bad human rights records. And the idea is that the human rights abuses by the government, these corporations were somehow complicit in. Now, the corporations are particularly attractive candidates because they have lots of money and are not protected by sovereign immunity, like the governments who are alleged to actually have committed the underlying human rights violations. Now, the Supreme Court has addressed significantly the alien tort statute once before in a case called Sosa in 2005, in which it had a very confusing and mixed decision, which on one hand permitted these suits to go on. There was some notion that the statute was only jurisdictional, that it did not actually create causes of action, but the court said that you can bring certain causes of action for a violation of the law of nations under this. They didn't say which ones. They just said that it has to be very well-defined and clearly established international law violations. And they gave some examples, things like what the people who wrote the statute were thinking about would be things like assaulting ambassadors, piracies, things that were in 1790 and are even still today international law violations that everyone could agree violates international law. Because, I should add parenthetically, international law is often vague. And indeed, the framers understood this. And this is what makes the ATS such a tricky statute. The Constitution provides that Congress has the power to define and punish offenses against the law of nations. That is, that they have the power to say what the law of nations actually means. Now, in the Alien Tort Statute, they did no such thing. They didn't define anything. They just said there's jurisdiction over suits involving the law of nations, but they didn't say what the law of nations means. Now, we know that the offenses clause was put into the Constitution because the framers, and they brought this up at the Constitutional Convention, thought international law was too vague and deficient to provide a rule that could be usable by courts. Who knows what international law means? So Congress has to come in and specify. Here they did not specify, and that leaves open lots of questions about what international law actually says. One of these questions concerns corporate liability. Does international law extend liability to corporations? Now, this may seem a surprising question for Americans, because in U.S. law, corporations are routinely held civilly and even criminally liable, even though corporations are not people, they have no will or agency, but they are held liable for their actions of their officers and employees, which basically means you are holding the shareholders liable. Now, that happens in the United States quite routinely. But in the rest of the world, it turns out, this does not happen. Corporate liability is a particularly American approach, and international law is not created by one country. So just like the jury trial is unusual and is not used, in, for example, in international tribunals, the question then becomes, does international law allow for corporate liability? Now, the second background point is that the whole notion that individuals can be held liable in international law is a relatively recent and limited development. Usually international law just applies to people, but various international law crimes, can the individual who commits them can actually be also held liable. That's a new development and an extension of what used to be the case. So has that also been extended to corporations in the law of nations? And And it turns out one can't find any cases in any international tribunal or any national court where, in the modern era, corporations have been held liable for violations of the law of nations. It's very hard to find any example, and probably you can't find any example whatsoever. That's not to say that corporations aren't governed by the law of nations, that they're somehow exempt, but liability in a lawsuit is not something that we see happening in international law. And several other European countries, generally themselves big exponents of human rights, filed amicus briefs saying that there is no such rule in international law. They filed amicus briefs on behalf of Shell. And it's very hard to find a case all the way back in the 1600s involving the East India Company, a case brought in British court. But clearly, even if one can find a spattering of 400-year-old precedent, corporate liability does not meet the standard set in SOSA, the previous Supreme Court case. The international norms of liability have to be clear and well-established. So what the plaintiffs point to, because they recognize that they're not going to make a good stand on international law, they say only the actual rules of primary conduct, the things you're not allowed to do, torture people, commit genocide, only those defined by international law under the ATS, for those you look to international law. For secondary issues, as they put it, things like who can you sue, corporate liability, there we can look to U.S. common law. That is to say that American courts can make up rules as the American rules to implement the top-level norms. Now, there's a couple of problems one might mention about plaintiff's position. And clearly, they would like the corporate liability defined by U.S. common law because in the U.S., again, corporate liability is not such a novelty. It would be maybe anomalous not to have corporate liability. So first of all, the statute that we're interpreting, the Alien Tort Statute, says violations of the law of nations. It only tells you to look at the law of nations. The law of nations is the whole game. The only reason U.S. courts are in the first place hearing this suit involving actions by Royal Dutch Shell in Nigeria against Nigerians is because of this statute. And if you are in with international law halfway, you have to go the rest of the way. International law is the whole game. And what the plaintiffs are learning is international law giveth, but it also taketh away. Secondly, it's hard to say what is a secondary issue. International law cares about primary conduct, but it also cares about who can be sued. And many norms of international law govern directly who can and cannot be sued. For example, is it a norm of individual liability or not? Can sovereigns be sued? These all come from international law. Jurisdictional rules come from international law. So it's not clear that this is outside the scope of international law. And finally, even if one were to say that this should be decided as a matter of federal common law, that judges could make up a rule, it's not clear that the rule should be corporate liability, because on one hand you might say it should be corporate liability because that's what the U.S. does the rest of the time, but here the U.S. is acting as a kind of international court, a forum for human rights abuses from around the world. And if that's what it's doing, then there's a good reason for the rules of liability to be in comedy, to be modeled on the rules used in the rest of the world, lest we invite forum shopping and basically the whole world running into U.S. court to adjudicate their disputes. So it's not clear that if we're applying international law norms, we should use, just even as a matter of comedy or judicial discretion, it would make sense to use the same norms of corporate liability we use when we're applying U.S. securities and conspiracy statutes and so forth. Now, we've mentioned that these lawsuits involve things that have happened around the world. In other words, they are applying U.S. law or allowing U.S. courts to adjudicate things that have little or no connection with the United States. Now, normally, that would not be the kind of case U.S. courts hear. First of all, an alien cannot sue another alien in U.S. courts for other kinds of torts. That is constitutionally prohibited. So there has to be something special going on here. And in general, the extraterritorial application of U.S. law is greatly disfavored by U.S. courts. And for a long time, the extraterritoriality and universal jurisdiction in these lawsuits were ignored by the courts or not treated as a problem. But recent briefs in some other cases have made a big issue of the extraterritoriality, and the Supreme Court has never said anything about it previously. And this seemed to worry the justices, or at least the conservative justices, a great deal at oral argument. They jumped right into the extraterritoriality issue, even though it was not actually one of the issues formally presented for review in this case. It is a big issue with the Alien Tort Statute. It is involved in this case, but it was not one of the issues that the lower courts had divided on that led to the Supreme Court taking this case, but they were greatly bothered by it. And pirates make a big appearance in the oral arguments, as they did in some of the briefs. Pirates were used as an example by the plaintiffs and apparently sympathetically by Justice Breyer for an example where commercial enterprises could have been held liable in the law of nations. And what that refers to is the fact that pirate vessels, when you caught the pirates, you could condemn their vessel. So this seems to be a proceeding against the pirate business entity attacking its assets. The problem, of course, is that the pirates were partners, and so there was no vicarious liability. That is to say, the pirates jointly owned the vessel, and so taking the vessel was direct punishment against the principal violators rather than some kind of vicarious liability onto shareholders. Now, Muhammad, briefly, was about another statute, the Torture Victim Protection Act, which was enacted after this human rights litigation under the ATS began. Congress passed a statute specifying what torture means and how that could be sued for in U.S. courts. That's an example where Congress actually did step in and define an offense against the law of nations. And they defined it something that an individual commits. The question is a corporation individual? And I would refer for further information listeners to my article in the Notre Dame Law Review about what piracy teaches about the Alien Tort Statute, and my forthcoming article, Discretion, Delegation, and Defining in the Offenses Clause, available online, forthcoming in the Northwestern Law Review. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.